Welcome to the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast, the show where brilliant professionals share how to sharpen the universal skills required to flourish at work. Enjoy more career fun, wins, meaning, and money with your host, Pete Mikaitis.
Hello, and thanks for joining us here for episode 748 with Karen Martin. Karen is back talking about clarity. If you've had some ambiguity in your professional world, like what did you want and what are we trying to achieve? And I'm confused and Karen is a breath of fresh air talking about clarity, how to provide it, how to request it and get it. So you'll learn one, how to speak your mind without coming off as harsh. Two, the one question to ask when someone's being unclear. And three, fuzzy words you should stop using immediately. So if you want to check out the show notes or the transcript or the links to items that we mentioned here, please pay us a visit at awesomeatyourjob.com/EP748 and check out some of the goodies at awesomeatyourjob.com, like the full text searchable transcripts, all the episodes tagged by the topic and competency covered, and a lot of other goodies over at awesomeatyourjob.com. Now, here's Karen's story. Karen Martin is the president of the global consulting firm TKMG Inc. and a leading authority on business performance and lean management. She's known for her keen diagnostic skills and rapid results approach. Karen and her team have worked with clients such as AT&T, Chevron, the IMF, Mayo Clinic, and many more to develop more efficient work systems, grow market share, solve business problems, and accelerate performance. Big thanks to Karen for sharing her wisdom with us, and big thanks to our sponsor, Lexus. I've long been impressed with the reliability and durability of Lexus vehicles. Now, the completely redesigned 2022 Lexus NX impresses with innovation as well. It's got a 14-inch touchscreen and an all-new intuitive interface designed to minimize distractions and frustrations. The 2022 Lexus NX has the most advanced standard active safety system ever offered in a Lexus, designed to protect you and your passengers and others on the road. The 2022 Lexus NX comes in gas, turbo, hybrid, and plug-in hybrid electric vehicle options. The PHEV model is available in states, excluding Vermont, that have adopted zero-emissions vehicle regulations. They've got a well-designed driver-centric cockpit with plenty of lovely features like a panorama glass roof, thematic ambiance illumination, and an all-new virtual assistant that can be summoned with a simple, "Hey, Lexus." To see the new NX and discover everything it was designed to do for you, visit lexus.com/NX, the all-new 2022 Lexus NX. Welcome to the next level. Now, here's Karen. Karen, welcome back to How to Be Awesome at Your Job.
It's great to be back, Pete. Thank you.
Well, you just said something funny before we pushed record, which was, you know, it's been a little over 3 years since you were on the show, and you commented that it feels like a lot more than 3 years. What'd you say?
In COVID times, that's a decade.
Yeah, it really is.
My gosh, it's so weird how warped time is, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
It's just weird.
It's wild. And last time we talked about clarity, and if listeners haven't checked out that episode, I recommend it. It's a good one, number 382. So I'd love to hit a little bit of some of those bits on clarity, and specifically the questions and questions about questions. And maybe for starters, can you tell us, in this 3 years or decade, depending on your perspective, have you discovered anything new about clarity or refined any of your thinking in a way that's super handy?
Oh my goodness. Well, let's stick on the COVID theme for just a moment. So talk about a lesson in the lack of clarity. Oh my gosh. I mean, it has been 3 years of the most incredible ambiguity I've ever seen in my lifetime. And, you know, it's everything from the debate about science and non-science. And I think the most incredible one to me is how unclear the media and the agencies have been on, when do you turn positive for a rapid antigen test? When do you turn positive for PCR? What does turning negative mean? And what, like, it's just, there's just no clear answer. And there is a clear answer. I'm a microbiologist from way back when, and there's a very clear answer on when you turn positive and negative on these tests, but they're just not communicating it well at all. Mm-hmm. So I think if you pay really close attention to any information you receive, you can feel when it's clear. Now, it may be clear and false, but you can at least feel when it's clear and when it's not. You get a visceral reaction when you're in the presence of ambiguity.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. And I guess I'm thinking about masks with regard to in the early stages, Because I had that feeling that in the early days, the guidance was, hey, yeah, go ahead and wear masks, but not N95 masks because our healthcare workers need those. And I was like, well, it sounds like the N95 masks are better than if that's who needs them.
Yeah.
And so that's actually not clear. So what I think you need to say to me is, use the inferior masks and make a sacrifice for the sake of public health because the healthcare workers need them. As opposed to what was unclear was like, well, so do the non-N95 masks do good things? Because I generally like to have the best thing if I'm going to get a thing. I'm sort of like all or nothing in a lot of ways.
Yeah, well, a lot of that. I give a lot of grace to the agencies and to the media as well in the beginning days,
yeah.
A lot of grace, because we didn't know. I mean, we just didn't understand how much the virus could penetrate different kinds of masks and all of these different things that took, you know, a lot of experience and a lot of research of that experience in order to figure that all out. So I will give a big pass in the very beginning. But I also think that we could have been a lot more honest about remember in the very beginning, it was you don't have to wear a mask at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because they were worried about healthcare workers, you know, having access to enough supply for them to be able to not be in harm's way. And so it just, the whole thing, I'll give a lot of grace because we were all in panic mode. The agencies, probably the most panic mode of anybody, because they were, you know, responsible for what happens and what the communication is and everything. But it continues to be an incredible lesson in clarity versus ambiguity.
And so, Karen, I love that notion of there's a feeling there. And so, and I think that I can brush it away too fast in terms of, it doesn't quite seem to make sense, but that's what the experts say. So, okay. You know, I don't know if that's what if I were to kind of put words to the feelings.
Yeah, don't brush it away. One of the things I talk about in the book, Clarity First, is that you have a right to receive clear information and you have an obligation to deliver clear information. And delivering clear information is such a gift. Because there are so many people that are afraid to deliver a clear message for various reasons. And we can talk about some of those, but it's being brave and being clear. You don't have to be harsh and clear. You can be frank and candid and it be very loving, actually. And so being the recipient of information, absolutely you have a right to have clear information and the obligation to ask for clarity when you don't get it.
Let's talk about courage and communicating clearly, rising of consulting days and the headlines that go on slides, because the best practice that has been drilled into my head from consulting is that we have a headline on the slide that conveys the key message takeaway, such as sales have fallen dramatically since 2012. All right. For example, as opposed to simply sales over time. And it does take some courage because, and I think the reason, and I've been accused in my clients of using sensational headlines. It's like, oh, okay. Are these sensational? I think it just tells you what's going on here.
Yeah.
They might be more sensational compared to sales over time, which isn't very instructive. Is that, well, the director of sales who started the job in that year is in the room and he or she could be super offended to like that you're putting a bright spot on. Oh, see, things went bad right around when this guy was there, even though you didn't say that. But I think it does take some courage to be clear because people's feelings can get hurt. So help us sort through that a little bit in terms of, in some ways, you don't want to have like the pure, naive clarity of a child who just says anything like, you're fat. Like, don't do that. But help us out, Karen. How do we get clear, but not be too offensive?
Yeah.
And do this dance.
So I think the key is to always communicate with love as the intention and not harm. And when you kind of go from a place of love, and you know, I know it's funny to be talking about jobs and work and love, but it really is, you know, there's two pure human emotions, love and fear. And when you have love as the intent of conversation, then you can be clear and not harsh or harmful or mean, or you know, it's easier when it's done with love. Now, tough love is a great phrase, and tough love can be a little hard to swallow. But if you deliver it in the right way, you know that you care about the person and you're delivering the information out of concern and caring and loving for the that person. And it can be a person at work. I mean, it's not, this love thing isn't just outside of work. That helps a lot. And I also think that when it comes to, you know, team-based meetings and activities and improvement activities and things like that, you have to kind of go into those with some ground rules about what the expectation is that the conversation should be like. And so the expectation should be, you know, ideally, that there's a safe environment to speak the truth, and that the truth is founded and grounded in facts, and that it is what it is, and it's not going to be blame oriented. I think that's where we get ourselves into really big trouble, is this blaming and finger pointing. You know, it's when you're trying to solve problems, which business is 90% solving problems, you have to not have a fear-based or a culture and an environment that's going to evoke fear because people are being blamed. So that helps a lot right there.
Yeah. And then maybe the other side of the coin may be credit. It's like, we need the credit. Like if you view, was it Abraham Lincoln talk about victory has 1,000 fathers, but failure is a lonely orphan or stuff like that.
Yeah. That's a really nice quote. Yeah.
In terms of if everyone wants to claim credit for the thing that's going well, and everyone wants to divest blame or involvement or association with the thing that didn't go so well. So I guess I was just talking with a buddy who mentioned like some groups, like, refuse to let someone mention a victory in another group's newsletter because, like, they're always getting the credit for the things and we need to get credit for the things. And I don't know their whole story, but that didn't sound...
That's a toxic culture right there.
That didn't sound like the best place to be from that little snippet.
That's a toxic culture. Yeah, you know, I think that the more we can just get unemotional about performance and projects that either work really well or don't work so well. And I love actually going into clients where they're dealing with some perceived negative situations where something was, quote, a failure, unquote, and get them to see it through a learning lens. You know, the fact that something didn't work out as well as you would like, that's the rich fodder for, well, why not? You know, what happened? And what can we not repeat the next time? And what should we do more of? And to increase our chances of success. And really reflecting on why something didn't work out so well is important. But yet we kind of rush to the next thing and don't take time to really learn from our failures. And I mean, it sounds overwrought to say, oh, you know, we learn from our failures, but you really do. It's not just a saying. You really do. You can, if you listen and reflect, learn a lot from failure.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so there are some emotional foundational things that kind of need to be present in order for clarity to even have a prayer of being around.
A fighting chance. Exactly. A fighting chance.
So then let's say we do have that, or at least we have enough of that. Let's talk about the underpinnings of clarity in terms of, I love in our last chat, when we talked about some of those key questions that you can use of others to get clarification, like why, what if, why not, how could we, what would have to be true if, as well as questions we can ask ourselves to determine, hey, am I clear? Is what I'm saying going to kind of make sense and feel clear? And you also have questions about questions. So Karen, I just want to talk about questions. Lay it on us.
Let's do.
If we're trying to get clear, what are the fundamental questions we should be asking ourselves and others?
Well, so let's talk about email communication, phone calls, picking up the phone and walking into a meeting or chatting or texting. One of the most important things to do is say, what is my intent? Why am I communicating with this person or this team or this organization or whoever it is? What do I want to achieve? And I think also being very, very precise on what are you asking for? Are you just sharing information just so they know? Are you sharing information because you want a decision? Are you sharing information because you want someone's opinion? Are you sharing information because you want someone to take action? If you can just be more precise on what you're seeking to achieve, it makes it a lot easier to be clear. And I get emails, and actually I even have, you know, a couple people on our team that I have to work so hard to understand what they're actually wanting to achieve in the email. And it's like, and it's like, wait, do you want me to make a decision? Do you want me to take action? Do you want me to
put
an opinion? You know, what do you want? So I, long ago, actually, one of my direct reports actually taught me early in my career how to put my intent, the very first sentence of an email, and then give the backstory and all the facts and all the details that are needed, just the essential facts that are needed. So if you just think about, I'd love to get your opinion on blah, 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 blah. I would love for you to help me with blah, 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 blah. Do you have time? Like, if you just are clear up front on what you want and then give any of the details that are necessary, people love it. Because they don't have to work to understand what it is you're asking for. And this is true of love relationships too. This is not just work. You know, this is family, friends, partners. It really is amazing how, when you're clear about what you're seeking to achieve, how much easier the communication can go.
Yeah, I love that. And it's just like that. It could be one sentence at the top of the email. I love your feedback. I love your decision. It's so funny. I'm thinking now about the email I get the most of in my life these days is pitches to appear on the podcast. So I think it's funny. And now I just know what people are going for. But I think it's funny how sometimes the emails will just sort of go into details. Like, Karen Martin is the president of the Global Consultant. It's like, okay, Karen is this. Karen is so great. It's like, okay, well, good for Karen. But like, what do you want from me? Well, now I know by shortcut. But I think that's sort of funny. Some marketing guru, I don't remember who it was, he said, I think that's one of like the cardinal sins of whether it's an about page or an email or a piece of marketing. It's about me, 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 us, us, us. Mm. And it's sort of like, well, no one cares. I mean, often about sort of maybe like the history or the founding of something, but as so much as the benefit that it provides me and or what do you need or want from me? Because sometimes I guess that's my test, is I would say, if this just feels like a press release, then I almost feel paralyzed. Mm. Not to be overdramatic here. Right. It was like, okay, thanks. It's like I'm reading a press release as opposed to, oh, did you want to buy our product or service? Did you want to interview this person? Did you want to explore this idea as an initiative for us, you know, in the next year? It's like, I need a little something. And I think sometimes you just assume that the person on the receiving end just knows. Mm-hmm. Like, it's sort of like if I get forwarded something and there's nothing at the top of it for me, mm-hmm. That's the trickiest for me, is like, okay, now what?
Yeah. And I think it helps a lot to think about life in general as a supplier customer relationship. You know, it's not just in business that we should be thinking about these things. So the supplier is the person who's communicating, and the customer is the recipient of that information. And I have a, you know, rule of thumb. I say, know thy customer, you know, and know what your customer's level of understanding is about the topic you're communicating. Know what their motivation is. Know what their what's going to grab them versus turn them off. You have to think a little bit. We are not all cut from the same cloth. We all have different learning needs, learning styles, communication needs, absorption needs. And so you have to, you know, not just brush everyone with the same brush. You have to think about, how do I properly convey to these folks whatever it is I want to share or ask for? Mm-hmm. You mentioned questions behind questions. And so that, we turn it around now. So that's when you're communicating with others. Now it's when people are communicating with you. And a lot of times it's so fascinating, if you start really paying attention to this, if someone asks you a question, sometimes it's very, very easy to understand why they're asking you, like, what time do you have to leave the meeting? It's, you know, it's very concrete, tangible, and they're asking for just a straight answer. But sometimes people will ask questions that the question actually isn't what they're asking. There's a question behind the question, mm-hmm. but out of fear, you're not getting the right question. And so if you pause, don't be so obligated to answer the question and say, that's interesting. I'm curious. Why are you asking that question? You have to ask it in a really gentle way. You can't go, why are you asking that question? You know, you have to say, I'm just curious why you're asking that question. Then you almost always will get the real question that they're asking. And it's fascinating to see how if you would have just started talking and answering the question, the first question, you would not have provided what they were actually asking. And they don't, sometimes, you know, people that are communicating, they aren't even aware that they're not being as truthful and forthright as they should be so that you can answer more clearly, you know, what they're asking for, because it's habitual. And so you can help someone out of that habit of being afraid or sugarcoating or just being kind of vague. You can help them by saying, I don't understand, or tell me more about that. What's behind that question?
Two examples leap to mind here, and I want to hear some more from you, Karen. One, it might have been from Gottman, since we talk about romantic relationships as well here, in terms of if a wife asks her husband, oh, are you cold? Which he's really thinking is, I'd like to have some intimate time in bed and to cozy up and warm that way. But she's maybe a little bit timid in terms of doesn't want to potentially feel rejection. So they say, oh, or are you feeling cold? And then the husband, clueless to the intention or behind the question, is like, nope. It didn't even occur to him that that was kind of what we were discussing here. And then I had a buddy, I was showing him the game Angry Birds, and this has cracked me up. He said to me, oh, and people find this engaging, which I clearly intuited meant he thought, wow, that looks dumb. I'm so surprised that there's like a lot of people who do this and like for a long time. Wow. They're surprised. So maybe you could give us some examples more in a workplace context. What are some times people are asking questions that aren't really what they're getting after?
Well, I work in the space of improvement a lot. And so a lot of times people will ask questions about why the improvement is important, or what, you know, what's going to likely be the outcome, when they're really saying, I'm very concerned, I'm afraid I'm going to lose my job, I feel like I'm going to lose power. So, you know, so the big threats in business are losing your job, losing power, losing budget, if you're at a budget level, mm-hmm. losing face, having people not respect you. You know, they're all kind of human, but they're a little more financially tied in business because of a paycheck. And so when they're asking a lot about, you know, well, why this and why that, and when it comes to, you know, an improvement or an idea, they're actually most of the time they're asking, you know, what guarantee can you give me that you're not going to make my work much more difficult, or I'm going to lose my job. And so if you ask what's behind the question, you often start, it starts coming out a little bit more. The other thing that can happen is, so you mentioned the questions. Let me go here, because I think it was tied to this. You said like, what would have to be true if, why not? What if, all those things. Mm-hmm. What I've learned actually since you and I talked, I think this is one learning I had, is that the question why, I already knew it could be laced with accusation and blame and harshness, but I've learned even more how laced it is. Mm. And so the thing that's easier on the ear and on the heart and the soul is a question that begins with what, because you can turn all questions into why. So like, why is he doing that? Sounds very accusatory. But the question could be turned around into, what conditions created the need to do that? Or what outcome is he trying to achieve, you know, doing that? Or something like that. It just has a little softer feel to it. What and how questions.
Yeah. What made you prefer that option?
Well, and you actually get people to, you know, to think deeply when you ask what and how questions. Why are also good thinking questions. So there's binary questions that are answered with yes, no, and those begin with should, could, do. You know, so they're all questions that are answered yes or no. The mm-hmm. ones that are Socratic in nature, meaning that they require you to, you know, answer a little more deeply and think a little more deeply, are the ones what, why, and how are the big ones. And then the ones that are kind of in the middle are the who, where. They're kind of a little more binary because they're easy to answer and concrete. The what, how, and why questions require thought. But of those three, I always place why as the last, kind of like the last place I go to. If I can't get the question answered better with what and how, I'll go to why. But mm-hmm. I try really hard to stick with what and how.
Okay.
Non-threatening, much more non-threatening.
Beautiful. Well, so that's a great notion associated about what's behind the question is it's often something, I don't mean this in a necessarily bad way, but it's sort of self-serving. And that's kind of why they don't just nakedly say it. Like, so is this going to reduce my power? You know, it kind of makes you seem like, oh, okay, we see what you're into. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, you care and you want to know. So you're asking. So then I'm curious, as we play out this conversation, how do you answer that well in terms of, well, one, I guess you ask what's behind the question, and they may or may not sort of directly say, I'm worried this will reduce my power. I'm guessing they likely won't.
Well, you'll get closer to that by asking the question behind the question, what the question behind the question.
Okay.
For sure.
Gotcha. So they might say, we just worked on this budget, and so we're just curious about the budgetary implications. It's like, okay, budgetary implications is pretty close to, are you going to take away my money?
Right.
And so you can go there. And then I guess with reassurances there, I guess maybe you answered that question, as I was just concerned that might seem too, I don't know, presumptuous or patronizing. I mean, I know you're not going to say, hey, relax, Mike, you're going to keep your budget. I know you're not going to say it quite like that. But any thoughts in terms of, as that conversation progresses, in terms of keeping it productive and feeling good?
Well, I want to highlight something that you said just about, like, I don't know, maybe 30 seconds, 20 seconds ago, that was really, really good. And you started your sentence with, I'm curious to learn, or I'm curious to learn. That is a wonderful phrase. It actually makes people relax a little when you ask things from a place of curiosity. And the cousin to curiosity I talk about in Clarity First is humility. And when you say, I'm curious to learn, humility is kind of implied there. Mm-hmm. And you can't, say it just to say it when you're actually have no interest in being curious, or and you have no interest in being humble. But if you are truly asking that question, which it sounded to me like you were truly from a place of curiosity, you're going to get a lot farther, because you're not going in with assumptions and biases and judgment and blame. Like, you really want to learn. And when you want to learn, people can relax and give you information you might never get. Mm-hmm. And then, by the way, these are techniques that law enforcement and intelligence use all the time when they're trying, and investigators of all sorts, when they're trying to get to the truth of a situation, they ask a lot of what and how questions, mm-hmm. to get people talking and relaxed so that they're more likely to reveal the truth.
That's cool. Well, I'd love it. Karen, can you give us some more phrases, questions about questions, magical phrases like I'm curious to learn? Let's hear some specific verbiage that's awesome often.
Data doesn't lie. Ooh. Unless the data has been fraudulently entered or faked. So I like data doesn't lie. And this is to get us away from the opinions, mm-hmm. that kind of come in at work when people say it's this. And you often just need to, and it doesn't have to be big and complex data analysis. Just getting some basic numbers and quantities and volumes and things like that can really help chip away at the opinions and get to facts. Mm-hmm. So data doesn't lie is another one. Fuzzy words. I love the phrase fuzzy words, which I talk about actually in The Outstanding Organization and that clarity chapter. I talk about fuzzy words are things where they mean different things to you and me. So it's things like long, short, heavy, light, mm-hmm. soon. It's a long time. I give this example of Starbucks. And when someone says the line's long at Starbucks, how many people is that? And if you ask a room of 20 people, you'll get a pretty good split between 2 to 4. And then there's like the 5 to 7 people. And then there's like the more than 7 people. And it's so interesting. And so those are fuzzy words you should avoid at all costs. And if someone uses them with you, you should ask for clarification. How many do you mean? I mean, if it's relevant, I guess a line at Starbucks.
Right, if you care.
Uh-huh. Yes, yeah, it's not all that relevant at work, but you should really start tuning in to those words that people use them all the time, these fuzzy words. And it's not necessarily because they're afraid to reveal the truth. It's a habit. Mm-hmm. It's just, you don't have to commit when you're using a word that means different things to different people.
Yeah, I think not having to commit, that's huge. I think especially like with soon. And it's like, oh, I'll get that to you soon or shortly. It's sort of like, I don't want to put myself on the hook.
Right. For, if you're talking to me, I'm going to ask you what you mean by that.
You'll have this within 9 days, you know, and then it's like, well, now I've given up some flexibility associated with my task management.
Yeah. And the other thing is that, you know, people have different expectations. So I think that most of the conflict in the world is because of misunderstood expectations. Mm-hmm. So let's think about a boss giving an employee a task or a job to do or a project or whatever. If the boss doesn't get precise with what the expectation is from a, not only a date, but also the quality of the results. And, you know, there's done, done, done. And that also is fascinating. It's fascinating to see how one person's definition of what done means, this project's done, is not at all what another person's idea of done is. And so you've got to ask for clarity. And on our project plans, we actually have a column. It says like, what is done? And done to some people is they've actually, let's say they're making an improvement. They've made an improvement. Done to someone else is they've made an improvement and people have been trained. Done to someone else is they've made an improvement, people have been trained, and it's now being managed and monitored. There's a measurement. And so you have to get really clear. And in I learned this actually from construction guys. And they were like, oh, you know, this is decades ago. They're like, oh, you know, well, you know, there's done in construction. And then, of course, I learned that that's true in every aspect of work. You know, all industries, all areas within an organization have that same fuzziness that, unless you ask for clarification, two people can expect very different things.
Yeah. Well, and that notion of the multiple dones kind of gets me thinking with regard to let's just say there's a meeting. Let's say I ask you for something, Karen, and we both know that the reason I'm asking you for this is because I've got a meeting coming up on February 3rd, whatever, with somebody. And so you understand that to be a deadline. Oh, I'll need to get this to Pete before February 3rd.
I know where you're going.
And so like, if we haven't discussed it, like most likely I'm expecting you will get this to me well in advance of February 3rd so that I can review it and or potentially share it with my boss and boss's boss and boss's boss's boss.
Right, maybe, right.
It, so that it's perfectly polished and done for February 3rd. And so,
yeah.
I think that's intriguing that I guess there's deadlines and then there's deadlines as well.
Yeah, it is true. There's a lot of clarification that needs to happen. And even the project itself, I see so many people at lower levels in organizations taking on requests from their bosses that they're not clear what the request actually is, but they don't feel comfortable asking for clarification. And I'm like, no, you have to feel comfortable asking for clarification. And if your boss is someone who's not willing to give clarification, you have to have a conversation with that person about why you're asking for clarification. Because sometimes, you know, sometimes someone can feel threatened if you're asking for clarification. You have to help them understand that you actually want to serve them.
Yeah.
You actually want to do well. You want to give them what they're looking for. You want to have them look like a superstar in their boss's eyes or whatever it is that you're doing. You're not doing it out of malice or threatening, assuming you're not. So I think it's a really important thing for everyone from the front lines all the way up the ranks to really get good at, is not taking on a project that they go, I'm not quite sure exactly what I'm supposed to be doing and what the outcome, like, what's the outcome? Mm-hmm. What are we looking for? What does good look like? That's another great question. What does good look like?
Yeah, I'm loving this. So what is done? What does good look like? When is soon?
Yeah, when is...
Keep them coming, Karen. What are some other favorite questions?
Well, I say, what do you mean by that a lot? Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that? That's a good clarification question.
Yeah.
And that's almost like the question behind the question. But in this case, the person probably has made a statement. And I was saying, what do you mean by that? And sometimes I'll say, what do you mean? What do you mean? I was like, well, tell me. Tell me more. And that's another thing. I'll say, tell me more.
Tell me more.
And it's not really a question, but tell me more is also a good way to get people to reveal a little more so you become more clear what they're actually communicating.
Mm-hmm. Lovely.
Yeah.
Well, Karen, tell me, anything else you want to make sure to mention before we shift gears and hear about some more of your favorite things?
Mm. I just want everyone to get infected with the zest for clarity and expect it, give it. It's just so, even, you know, people say, well, sometimes the truth hurts. Yeah, sometimes the truth does hurt, but at least you know what you're dealing with. I just don't think that if you don't know what's going on, how do you possibly make any positive, you know, a positive step in the right direction? Even if it's the worst possible news you could ever get, then you know what you're dealing with and you can deal with it then. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you really don't know which way to go. So go for it. Everyone who's listening, go for it.
All right. Thank you. And now could you share with us a favorite quote so that you find inspiring?
This is going to sound funny. It's actually an advertising tagline. I really love the Nike Just Do It. Mm-hmm. It's not really a quote per se, but I just think that we just live in a fear-based bubble too much. And I love Just Do It.
All right. And a favorite study or experiment or bit of research?
My favorite research in decades has been the one that uncovered the fact that there's no such thing as multitasking. And it was a study Professor David Meyer at University of Michigan did. He studied engineers and he was studying how much time they take during the day, task switching from one kind of work to another kind of work, and how much productivity that robbed them of, and how much stress it added, and how much it risked a quality problem because of this juggling. So, you know, when I see job, not as much anymore, thankfully, but I used to see a lot job postings that would say, must be comfortable with ambiguity and must be able to multitask. Well, first of all, we don't want people to be comfortable with ambiguity. No, 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 no. We want people who are truth tellers and truth seekers. And we also don't want people that are able to quote multitask, because it's absolutely impossible to do two cognitive activities at the same time. It's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And so that research was really compelling. And when I, you know, work with clients on prioritization, you know, the key is to say not yet to those things that can wait, but to do fewer things at once. And you'll get so much more done in the same unit of time if you do fewer things at once, complete them, then move on, and complete them, then move on. I mean, you can get triple the output by doing fewer things at once and not juggling.
Okay. And a favorite book?
My favorite fiction book is The Sun Also Rises by Ernest Hemingway. And I did my first book report on that. And I just love that book. There's so much in that book. My favorite business book, well, besides my own, I would say is Out of the Crisis by Deming. It's an old book. It's a thick book, but it's really powerful about the ways businesses operate and keep themselves in crisis mode and how to break. There's different principles that you operate. And lean management is actually heavily based on a lot of Deming's work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I love that book, Out of the Crisis.
All right. And a favorite tool, something you use to be awesome at your job?
Well, I love value stream mapping, which is not for everyone. It's a more strategic tool, so it'd be for, you know, directors and above in an organization. For directors and below, I would say, I think one of the most important skills is to get really, really good at email management. I'm a big believer in zero inbox. I never get to true zero, but I get to, you know, teens, and it's so much easier to do that than to have these hundreds or thousands of emails in your inbox robbing you of, I call that existential inventory. You know, it robs you of, you know, the psychic energy you need to be productive. So get control of those inboxes.
Okay. Is there a key nugget you share that connects, resonates with folks? They quote back to you often?
It's not a quote, but when I work with companies on clarity, I will often hear people in the hallway, in the cafeterias or whatever, go, curse you, Karen Martin. And I'll say, why? Because I can't handle not having clarity anymore. And I said, mission accomplished. But you know, it is funny how many people go, oh my gosh, I had no idea how much ambiguity I allowed in my life and I contributed to until I met you and read the book or whatever it might be. So it's kind of a curse you thing.
All right. And if folks want to learn more or get in touch, where would you point them?
Got two websites, TKMG. So I used to be the Karen Martin Group, but we shortened it to, so I have a whole team now. So it's tkmg.com. And then we have an online learning academy, which is new since you and I last talked. And that's tkmgacademy.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And do you have a final challenge or call to action for folks looking to be awesome at their jobs?
Yeah, I think it's just starting tomorrow. Listen, 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 and feel what you're feeling and start paying attention to when things are clear, when they're not clear. Listen to how you're communicating, reread your emails, like just start becoming aware. Like just take that first step. You don't have to do anything yet. Just start becoming aware of the degree of ambiguity and or the degree of clarity that is around you and that you're contributing to. Mm-hmm. Just become aware, and that alone can start moving mountains.
Okay. Beautiful. Karen, this has been a treat once again. I wish you much clarity and fun in your adventures.
Thank you, Pete. It was really nice to talk with you again. I love your questions. So thank you.
I really loved Karen's take about the fuzzy words. What is a lot and what is soon? We could have wildly different interpretations of that. So let's just put a number on it, put a date on it, and we feel all the more clear and connected and on the same page. So again, the show notes, the transcript, the links to items we reference are at awesomeatyourjob.com/EP748. Hope to catch you next time, and peace.
Thanks for listening. To get the most out of the show, we recommend two key things. First, check out the extra resources at awesomeatyourjob.com. You can find this episode's transcript and links, as well as the perfect episode for your situation. You can search the full text transcripts of hundreds of episodes or explore episodes tagged by topic and competency covered. Second, subscribe to the podcast and get future episodes automatically. You can subscribe by telling Siri and several other smartphones and speakers, subscribe to the How to Be Awesome at Your Job podcast, or by tapping subscribe in your podcast player of choice. If you'd like some extra help figuring out podcasts and how subscriptions work, visit awesomeatyourjob.com/subscribe for guidance. Hope to catch you on the next episode of How to Be Awesome at Your Job.